to each other's ratings. So that was a fairly large number of clients. We also did another iterator reliability where I went to Massachusetts and trained the staff of a large mental health provider in Massachusetts, and that was the study with 105 clients who were rated by various members of staff who were also blind to each other's ratings. And they got just slightly higher. That was the 0.86 coefficient that was mentioned.
Smart.
Those are the two iterator reliability studies that we did.
Are there any further questions about reliability testing?
Yes.
Could you comment? We've had some reaction to the fact that the test can be given in 15 seconds and with these raters. Is that true?
Well, it's based on the staff knowing the client that they're rating. So
okay, that makes sense.
Fundamentally, I think somebody mentioned the fact that these are for folks who are considered to have a severe and persistent mental illness and have been in the system for quite some time. Here in California, these folks are primarily served in what are called full-service partnerships, so we have very low caseloads of about 1 to 15, 1 to 17. So every month, all of our staff rate the consumers, on the clients on their caseload, and literally takes about 15 seconds. Because if you know the client, you know what their risk factors are, what their level of engagement is, and what their level of skills and supports are. So it doesn't take long at all. We work as a team, on a team basis, so it's not unusual that everybody on the team would know people on everybody else's caseload. And that's how we can do iterator reliabilities that are so high, because the staff do know members who, aren't necessarily on their caseload, but we're very familiar with all of them.
So another way to put that is it only takes 15 seconds to decide on a Likert scale rating and circle it. But can you estimate how much time at any cross-sectional assessment the caseworker or whoever's following this client, how much assessment time they actually take to find out how they're doing, how they're behaving, how they're functioning, how's their week, how's their last 2 weeks been going? Because they're interacting with that person, making a clinical assessment, and that clinical data then translates into the 15 second scoring. Okay.
If you brought in an independent assessor to obtain a score, how long would it take them to achieve a valid ability to put down a valid score?
Although what I'm really asking is, in the real world with the assigned caregiver, how long does it take that person who also knows enough of the history that they don't have to reiterate it at every subsequent measurement time period,
what's the marginal? Yeah, what's the marginal level
exactly.
of effort needed at the next measurement?
Because that's really what we're in terms of the burden of the instrument and what it takes to actually accomplish this. That's the real measure of
right.
effort.
I think I understand your question, and as we explain in our manual, we actually encourage people to use the MORS in one of two ways. You can use it as an individual measure where basically the case manager thinks about how the person is doing, tries to assess them on the three constructs of risk, engagement, and skills and support, and then comes up with that. And because they're meeting with their clients regularly, you don't see huge shifts in those underlying constructs from day to day. So we've also done a lot of looking at sort of like the stability of ratings over time. And so when I heard somebody questioning, well, what's the numerator and the denominator in terms of what's the time frame, is that we're looking at periods of a year to 2 years in terms of people who may enter the program when they come off the streets. They may be why we think that it really should be considered an outcome measure. But the other thing about the way that we rate folks is that we often encourage our own teams to do the ratings as a team. So our teams meet once a week to discuss how their members are doing, how their clients are doing. And so during that team meeting, during the discussion, different people, different staff on the team may have different information about how the client is doing. That is all kind of put together into and the client is given a rating based on that discussion.
If I understand,
that team meeting can be used in that way.
A couple of further questions, Maureen. We have an unusual placement of microphones, so we have to wait till they're shuffled around.
Hi. Have you done any reliability studies looking to see what kind of inter-rater reliability there is when you compare an individual rating versus a group rating?
No, we have not done that.
Thank you.
Since these measures are ultimately being proposed for accountability purposes, do you have any standardization of time frame or other specification here that would make this a more suitable measure for those purposes? In other words, if I measure it at 1 year and Eric measures it at 3 years, and his population's a little bit less sick because they're not getting patients who might have fallen into the criminal justice system, yada, yada, yada. It sounds like we might be well comparing apples and oranges, and that for accountability purposes, this measure wouldn't be appropriate. Or am I misunderstanding what you're proposing?
Are you collecting data on the mean times that are spent at any given level of recovery to know what? So at this,
we've also got some papers in press, or under review to sort of like look at what are those average times in our own programs as well as others.
And the converse, time to relapse or regression to a lower level. Are there data at this point that you've collected on that as part of a recovery trajectory where they may have bumps in the road and setbacks and then advances? two steps back, one step forward?
And we're looking at that as part of this paper. But I can tell you that the one study that we've had, you know, going on this, for example, the early data, for example, the kinds of information that we're hoping to get out of this is that for all of the people who come into our village program, for example, is that based on our milestones of recovery data, what I can tell you is that anybody who comes into the program at a relatively high risk, that is to say they're a 1, 2, or 3 when they come in, is that within 1 year, if you look down the road 1 year at their recovery, there's still about a 6% chance that they would be still at that high risk category. So 94% of our folks after 1 year are now above the high risk category if they came in as a high risk person. So that's the kind of information. Now, is that particularly good for a program, particularly bad for a program? I don't have any benchmarking data, yeah. So I can't tell you that. But those are the kinds of information that we're trying to use the milestones of recovery scale to help us to understand.
Eric, and then Bill.
I think we have here a really good example of a field-developed, program-developed measure, which is maybe jumping too quickly, but is not ready for nationwide implementation and prime time, but not only needs to be encouraged at the local level to develop it, but really to bring in some of the technology of the folks to do the you know, some of the critical issues around risk adjustment and the questions that we've asked about inter-rater reliability, if you have an outside objective observer, some of the validity testing, using it with different populations, et cetera. It's on a topic that's incredibly important, and it may be a measure that could be ready for prime time at some time in the future if developed. On the other hand, there are so many challenges in right here on the scientific acceptability that it's very difficult at this point to go forward, I think, at a national level and say, yes, let's support this.
I've got Bill and then Harold.
In a similar comment, I think that it has great promise as a quality improvement measure, but because of the problem with validation, I'm not sure it could ever become a accountability measure. So depending on how you pose the vote, I could not endorse this or support this scientifically for an accountability measure.
Harold?
Actually, I agree with both of the previous comments, but also I think there's issues of usability in terms of understanding sensitivity to change and what are the elements that actually influence that change, so that if organizations are seeking to apply this as a, and it kind of goes along, Bill, with what you were saying, if organizations are seeking to use this as a quality improvement strategy, sort of how do they improve? What are the mechanisms to do that? Would be important to begin to elucidate.
So I'm hearing from the group a lot of excitement that this type of measure is being developed, but concerns about some of the basic scientific acceptability currently, things like the risk adjustment, looking at disparities of care, population differences, the validity, reliability when you have naive observers or objective observers. Are we ready to vote on scientific acceptability? Let's go ahead then and completely on scientific acceptability. Partially.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah. Minimally.
What we're doing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 13.
Okay. Let's move on to usability. We've already had some comments in this direction. Further discussion of usability. Do you have something, Sheila?
I think Carol's comments address this, and part of this is just interpretation and the meaningful. I mean, it's, you know, you're going in a direction of improvement, but what that improvement actually means in terms of outcomes and being able to apply that as an accountability measure, I think there are huge gaps still.
Any further thoughts from the group on usability before we vote? Okay, completely. Seeing none, partially. Minimally?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
And then not at all.
Okay.
Okay. Let's go ahead to feasibility. Remember that this is a byproduct of care, the issue of burden, ability to electronically incorporate such measurement, exclusions, looking at inaccuracy in the implementation issues here. Thoughts from the group, please.
It sounds like the measure is embedded in a practice based on a model, based on the recovery model. Certainly, it sounds like this is being talked about all the time, and this is a framework that the interdisciplinary team uses to talk about patients' recovery. So I think those are strengths.
I think one of the big limitations is in the material that we were given, it shows that this is something that is, again, what you said, embedded in a program. And in fact, it's one of the leading, most reputable recovery programs in the country. And the replicability of it, I think, is fairly low until we see some evidence that it is replicated, that they don't mention at all things like exclusions. I think is really a problem with a measure like this. You know, is are cognitively impaired individuals going to be excluded? Patients with organic brain syndromes, patients who are substance abusers. I mean, there are a whole lot of different criteria. And the data collection strategy, I think, reflects that this is part of their program and hasn't been taken out to more programs to test it. So I think those are real limitations, not that they couldn't be overcome, but I don't think at this point that it's ready for that.
So again, I think the sense that I had is that this is a great start, but we're not at the accountability stage yet. So any further comments on feasibility? Let's go ahead then and vote completely, partially. Minimally.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
Not at all?
One. Okay.
Okay. I think we've had a robust discussion, have been impressed by the work being done, but. Pardon me? Yes, I'm getting up to recommendation. Yes or no?
You're leaving.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. How many would vote in favor of adopting this measure? Yes. And the noes?
17, Bill left.
Okay, so 17. Bill, do you vote yes or no? Okay,
18.
Thank you.
Were there any abstentions? Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so again, for the sake of our developer, I think the committee is enthusiastic about the potential of this concept and measure, but there are many issues which the feedback from the group and staff can be passed on, and we sure hope that this will lead to a measure in the future. So thank you very much for taking the time today. Is there any public comment?
No.
Okay, yes. Thank you very much for taking time today. Let us go ahead then and move on to our next, which is time from first face-to-face treatment. Ian? Medication developers. Yeah, well, is it Lily represented it here?
Who is the developer?
Who? Baltimore.
Do you know, Donald, have we heard if Baltimore substance abuse is on the line?
We're here.
Oh, they are here. For those major developers from Baltimore substance abuse, can you just state who's on the phone?
There are a couple of questions around the table of just briefly your organization, who you are, 2 minutes or less. Thank you very much. We appreciate your taking time. There may be questions along the way. We have a fairly structured approach here, but there may be some issues which we wish to clarify. Ian, did you want to just go over the specifications overall?
Can do. So right now we're currently looking at measure number 13. So it's time from first face-to-face treatment encounter to buprenorphine dosing. Number of hours of opioid-dependent non-pregnant adults the description is number of hours opioid-dependent non-pregnant adults aged 18 or older have to wait between their first face-to-face treatment encounter and receiving their first dose of buprenorphine medication. Numerator statement reads as follows: opioid-dependent patients receiving their first dose of buprenorphine medication. Denominator statement reads, the event of adult 18 years of age or older, opioid-dependent, buprenorphine-appropriate, and treatment counseling patients receive the first dose of buprenorphine.
Okay, so those in the group, would you care to address, is this a outcome measure or process measure? And I was, frankly, pretty skeptical that this was an outcome that's relevant to patients. I mean, there may well be symptoms or issues that result from a delay, but I didn't quite see this as a patient-oriented outcome myself, or at least I had some concerns about that. So, Richard and Harold.
Can I comment on the extent to which there's data that this time interval relates to an outcome? Right. Is this an intermediate outcome? Is there good data that, if you know, understand the question, I hope. I'll rephrase it if I need to.
And maybe that's a good thing to put to our measure developer, but is this a causal pathway or an intermediate outcome to patient-oriented outcomes that would matter?
What's the nature of that data that you say there's some evidence or you have evidence that the time to starting buprenorphine is tied to retention and treatment? Like, on what's the nature of the evidence that exists for that?
They cited the clinical practice guideline, by the way.
Are you still there? No. Did you hear the question?
No, can you repeat the question?
Okay.
Just so you can refresh us about the nature of the evidence that ties the time to dose to your outcome, which is, you're saying, retention and treatment. What's the nature of that evidence?
There's
another intermediate. Right, and where is that? Is that published? Is that an accepted scientific finding?
That has been reported in quite a few research studies looking at rates of show dependent on the length of time to first appointment. It is not specific, as far as I know, to buprenorphine dosing. It has more to do with the length of time between initial contact requesting service and the first service. And that's extensively reported on the Niatex website. Again, there is no reason not to believe that the sooner you get buprenorphine dosing, that the greater is the likelihood of retention. But I doubt that there is any buprenorphine-specific data that says some interval is better than another or that it's anywhere different for buprenorphine than for something else. On the other hand, we have a measure that is before us which is specific to buprenorphine dosing, even though perhaps the committee might be interested in length of time to first appointment more generally for either substance use or for behavioral health.
I guess my concern is that this is more distant from outcomes than a number of the other processy things that we looked at.
Yeah, I mean, certainly my sense in initially reading this is that this was somewhat removed. And I think it's a judgment call because clearly, there is some relationship, and how important you judge that causal pathway to retention in treatment and ultimate patient-oriented outcomes is in the eye of the beholder. Sheila, Luke, what did you think about that?
I had trouble deciding. I looked at this as an intermediary outcome that was important, and it's important to look at, but where you draw the line between what we want to include versus exclude. The fact that there are no other measures makes me inclined to say perhaps we should stretch on this issue. But again, I'm neutral.
I'm going to let Luke, and then we'll get, yeah.
And I was stretching too, especially with the developer's discussion of tip 40 as being evidence. And I wondered whether this particular organization was using that and then trying to get more data about whether something was effective or not. So they were developing a measure to prove what may not have been really strong in the TIP.
We'll go down the line.
It's fairly clear FDA approved buprenorphine because it shows that reduction of craving and of opiate use goes down if a patient is taking buprenorphine compared to placebo or to other medications. Therefore, it's not a stretch to say if you get a patient started on the medication, which is known well to be effective in reducing opiate use, that it might be linked as a process towards an outcome which is well known.
Rich? Okay, are there any members of the committee that would say this should be taken out because of out of scope? Maybe we should go ahead and take a vote then. How many of you believe this is in scope, that it's sufficient as an outcome measure, or as we've stretched things a bit, an intermediate outcome measure? How many would you vote yes?
And this is as a concept, not as a specific measure.
This is right now we're looking sort of, are we going to get the conversation going or are we going to stop it right here?
I've got 12.
For it doesn't really matter. I think we've got enough. So we're going to go ahead. Too bad. Yeah. I wanted to be inclusive there. Come on. Okay, let's talk about then importance. We've already had some conversation toward that. My concern is for an accountability measure, this was a very narrow focus, and that was my comment, I think, up here. And there wasn't a lot of supporting data. There was some. And I think we've heard the nature of that data already. So let me turn to Sheila and Luke and then open it up.
I thought it was important. I thought this is an important topic, and the framing of it using the evidence from the TIP was substantial, I thought.
Other comments?
Accountability measure. I mean, I kind of agree. I think it's very narrow. If this was framed as, you know, something, I mean, broader as Eric has gone, but something more like what Eric described as something that was sort of looking at a larger set of time to, you know, to engagement in treatment in some way for a broader population, it would have more utility. And so, you know, I just don't see this being picked up a lot except as an internal quality improvement measure, but not as a large-scale accountability measure.
I have a question for the staff. This, given that this is a much more narrow measure than anything that we've seen before, are there other measures that are this narrow and sort of look at such a small population?
Definitely. I mean, there's over 600 measures in the portfolio, and some of them are very narrow. The question is, you know, and this is more philosophical than policy, is that appropriate? Is that useful in the large, grand scheme of things? And that we put back to you and ask you to advise us.
I find myself thinking of, like, the time of antibiotics to certain outcomes. But the data that ties that intermediate outcome measure to be acceptable is pretty robust data in terms of the outcomes that they're talking about. And here it's by implication. Eric's not here. He said there's no reason not to believe that this wouldn't have an impact on retention and treatment, which should have an impact on outcomes. but it's not really at the point, the same point of antibiotics and the ER for pneumonia treatment.
I mean, it's an intermediate outcome to another intermediate outcome.
Yeah.
I would argue, though, that for substance abusers, it's not a fair comparison to infectious disease, that engagement and retention and treatment may be more challenging with that population and that particular set of health problems. So I think the argument made by the measure developer that, you know, it could make a difference and literally, and indeed is an intermediate outcome measure, I think is persuasive enough.
And I think the relief of pain, suffering, symptoms in and of itself is a pretty substantial patient-oriented outcome. And if one's suffering longer...
Right, but there is a slippery slope. I mean, you start to let this in the door, you could have thousands of measures like this that could be submitted and
right.
and presented for...
The first antidepressant.
I don't disagree, although...
Retention and treatment would be a more proximal to outcome.
Well, and with depression, you could argue time to, not to first dose, but to first appointment could be important. I mean, you can imagine similar things.
Right, but we almost knocked out the measurement-based care as not being processed,
right.
you know, being too processy. So I'm just, you know.
Yeah, no, I think there is a certain in the eye of the beholder here. How about gap in relationship to outcomes? I think we've already covered. Anything further?
You know, I guess I wonder if we would have had more submissions of other sorts of these where it was, you know, time from treatment to prescription of antidepressants, would we have a different conversation? We just happen to only have one of them. So I think that that's something to consider as well.
I also think that the topic is important to consider. I mean, we're talking about importance to measure and report, and I don't know that the rest of the categories will show that it's worth adopting, but I do think that in terms of importance to measure and report, you know, it's a substantial problem, and I think that whatever we can do to measure the differences that occur because of prompt treatment would be worth looking at. So in terms of importance, I think it should be considered.
Can we, for NQF staff, what do we have in the library of measures for substance abuse outcomes?
Or just period. I mean, this is a process measure, so what do we have process?
Yeah, there's like two or three. Most of what work we've done in substance abuse has been around practices. I'd have to go back and look, but there are very few, and they're process measures.
Yeah, aren't two of the Washington Circle measures?
The Washington Circle measures, and I don't think there's much beyond that.
Yeah, but I guess that's well, maybe it's when we get the harmonization issues that it seems to me that this is encompassed to some extent by the Washington Circle measures.
I'm a little, you know, obsessed with the outcomes part. If this is an intermediate outcome towards some outcome, why don't we tell them, present the outcome? Forget the intermediate part. What's the outcome that this is intermediate towards? And I'd like to consider that measure.
So
otherwise, you get into, you know, the problems, micromanagement and, like, thousands
of... Retention and treatment.
Well, then let's have them present that.
So I hope the measure developer is hearing this conversation about where the outcome is. Well, let's go ahead and vote on importance here. Completely? Partially? Minimally? And, okay, so we're set on that. Let's go ahead then and move on to scientific acceptability. So, I mean, just to telegraph my thoughts here, I thought that the analysis that at least was presented around things like reliability, validity, was very thin, if at all. And I saw that as an important weakness. Sheila, what were your thoughts?
Well, I would probably echo some of your comments in terms of testing. Again, it's looking at it as an intermediate outcome, even the relationship to improved retention. I mean, there's large suggestion. It comes from a lot of the clinical trials, whether I think it's whether we're looking at it as a process or an outcome measure of comfort level in terms of scientific validity.
Luke?
It actually stated, the developer actually stated that there was no formal reliability and validity testing.
Likewise, risk adjustment was not considered and suggested no risk adjustment necessary, which I guess probably you could say there should be a standard that's applicable across all types of patients. At least that would be maybe more sellable. But if you're going to do different populations across different programs, it might have an impact. Thoughts, comments from the committee as a whole on this? Let's vote then, completely. Partially. Minimally.
Twelve.
And then not at all.
Four.
Okay. Let's move on to usability. Again, I just thought there was a relative dearth of data.
And I think there needs to be some effort of harmonization with the existing NQF measures, because I think they may, in fact, encompass and be better than.
The notes here say that there are no similar related endorsed or submitted measures. Is that accurate?
Well, I'd have to look at the details of the Washington Circle measures. Those have been endorsed. I'd have to look at the details of them, actually.
Initiation, engage,
yeah.
Identification, initiation, engagement.
Then it...
Initiation is essentially looking at sort of, you know, going from identification to first assessment.
Other thoughts in this arena while we're looking up the Washington Circle?
NCQA is the steward.
Is it NCQA?
Yeah.
Oh, did you?
Good, right on, one more. Go right down. There it is. There we go.
So we'll just at least get your percentage of statement. So let me read it out loud, because I don't think you can read it.
No.
So it's the percentage of adults aged 18 and over diagnosed with AOD abuse or dependence and receiving a related service who initiate treatment, assessment of the degree to which members engage in treatment with two additional AOD treatments within 30 days after initiating treatment. So it's two pieces, initiation and then within 30 days. So the second piece does. So the first piece is the number, anyone who's diagnosed and receives a related service and initiate treatment. So just that, the number. And then the second piece is how many engage with two additional treatments within 30 days.
From the initiation.
Yeah.
So the gap to initiation
right.
could be huge. And you know,
I think right. there's a time frame.
There may, unfortunately, I don't have the specs. We could pull up a little bit more detail. I think there is.
Okay.
It's just not in the description.
Okay,
so there is at least some overlap at a broad level, whether you think it's important for this particular focused measure or not, I think is, again, up to the group. Any other comments on usability? Then let's move on to vote completely, partially, minimally. Not at all.
1, 2, 15.
We lost. Okay. Let's move on then to feasibility. You want to start off, Luke, and tell us your thoughts about feasibility?
I think what I said here is performance is limited to a group in a city. Current system features aren't well described. Didn't really get a good sense of how burdensome this is.
Sheila?
Yeah, I thought it seemed to be fairly straightforward in terms of getting the time to treatment within a system. So it seemed that the data would be readily accessible. But they don't elaborate on the methodology.
Yeah, I guess from a sort of face validity standpoint, it sort of made sense that this would be relatively feasible to do, but there were no real data, or this is basically one system's ability to do this, and whether it transfers to other settings, I think, is unknown. Harold?
I would think it would be, for the most part, for a large system, it would be very difficult to do because you have to combine. It's based on hours, and I don't know, you know, the time for figuring out the hour of dosing, you know, from the time, you know that you know you couldn't use claims, you couldn't. I mean, it's a.
I have also formulated for like these issues regarding patient confidentiality.
So issues of patient confidentiality. Okay. Other concerns, questions, comments?
Yeah, I guess I would suggest that they look at doing a research study first because it doesn't make sense to me to look at the time to actual treatment without knowing that it makes a difference. So I think that what I'd recommend is that they do a research study, find out what that shows them, and then look at outcome measures.
You know, the measure developer does note that data is easily obtained as long as data entry occurs in a timely manner. Data needs to be entered daily into the database to ensure accurate tracking and efficient workflow, which sounds to me like a separate process. It does not occur as a routine part of care, if you will. Okay, if there aren't any other comments, then let's vote completely, partially, minimally. And then not at all. Okay, then let's go on and go ahead and vote. How many of the group would recommend yes adoption of this? How many would recommend no? Any abstentions? Any public comment? I want to thank the measure developer. I think everybody is very supportive of the concept here. I think some suggestions about how to go from where you are, it really would be possible, I think, perhaps for us to move on to more of an accountability measure by looking at ultimate outcomes, retention, and treatment. Let's see. The next one, same developer? Yes. Well, let's go. Percent of eligible patients who transfer.
All right, so we're moving on down to number 17. Thank you, Heidi. So moving on down to number 17, percentage of eligible patients who transfer from a substance abuse treatment program to a continuing care physician for ongoing buprenorphine maintenance therapy. The description reads as follows. Percent of adult patients 18 years of age or older who meet eligibility criteria to transfer from a substance abuse treatment program where they have been induced, stabilized on buprenorphine and received counseling services to a continuing care physician in the community who will continue the patient's buprenorphine treatment and will provide other needed mental health and psychosomatic health services. Numerator statement reads, the percent of adult patients who began buprenorphine treatment and at a substance abuse treatment program who upon stabilization on buprenorphine and upon meeting transfer eligibility ensured stable negative urine drug screens responsible with prescription handling, transfer their buprenorphine to health care services to a continuing care physician in the community. The denominator statement reads, all patients who were inducted and stabilized on buprenorphine in a substance abuse treatment program and who meet the transfer criteria are stated as ensure stabilized negative urine drug screens responsible with prescription handling, regardless of whether they ultimately transferred the care, their care to a continuing care physician in the community or not.
So, again, I guess you could ask, is this a patient-oriented outcome, retention and treatment? We'll probably have the same set of issues.
This seems even further away. I mean, why does somebody need to be transferred? Why does somebody need to be transferred?
Should we ask the measure developer? Are you still on the line?
Is that what we're talking about then is an outpatient substance abuse treatment program where, say, someone who is a non-physician has assessed someone as potentially benefiting from this medication, and so now the person is being referred to a physician who has this expertise? Is that what we're talking about?
Appropriate services is what I understand this measure.
I understand it that they're in a specialty substance abuse program, probably being treated by a physician, and they're met some criteria so that they no longer need that level of care and can return to primary care.
Okay, thank
you.
Okay, all right.
I didn't know if that was the norm, though.
Yeah.
I don't think it is.
Some people do it, but it's not necessarily a path to outcomes. Well,
I would think that it might be more a reflection on the comfort level of the primary care physician and not so much on the patient.
Well, I mean, their description is patients able to continue to receive maintenance therapy, convenient office setting, other somatic or mental health services, mitigating relapse. Continuing care physicians are able to take care of already inducted and stabilized in insured patients, so practice office settings do not need to be altered to accommodate time-consuming and sometimes difficult and or uncompensated induction protocols, waiting room disruptions, yada, yada. And three, the stable patient transitioning out of the publicly funded treatment slot and substance abuse program, a new patient in need of service is able to enter the program.
It sounds like a utilization outcome to me as opposed to a quality outcome.
But I mean, I can certainly see that it could be a quality outcome if the treatment program made the determination that this is somebody who is appropriate for maintenance treatment, then it would be, I think, a responsibility of that program to do whatever it could do to ensure that they got into the next stage of treatment, which would include maintenance. And presumably not everybody is a candidate for this, and I'd be interested in what the eligibility criteria were, but presumably the eligibility criteria would include being appropriate for a more of a long-term maintenance buprenorphine treatment that might involve other treatments as well.
If this has something to do with getting out of a specialized treatment system into a primary care treatment system, we don't even know if that works.
But with an appropriate provider, though. I mean,
even with the appropriate provider, I mean, it's conceivable to me they may make that transition and then drop out after a week. So I don't know what the outcome is. Just to say that we got rid of some people, we transferred some people to the primary care system, is a ambiguous outcome to me.
Yeah, and this is the equivalent of saying that somebody who's been seen at a specialty mental health center got transferred to a primary care provider. I mean, it may be appropriate for some people, but I don't see how it's related to all that.
The way I read it was that she was describing a community standard that someone is inducted, they go to maintenance to a person who's familiar with this medication and has gone through the training to medicate this person. That's how I read it.
Right, but what's the counterfactual? The person remains in the substance abuse treatment program.
Or doesn't have or is lost to treatment, or isn't retained.
Right, but that's,
I thought I heard something in there that you move them out of the specialty so you can make room for a new person.
That's what I mean. I think it's.
I mean, this is from the perspective. This is from the perspective of a community health service agency, and what their goals are to get the patients induced and then get them into ongoing care and a whole array of services. Yeah. Now, whether that's an appropriate outcome measure or not, I think is the first point here. Is this in scope or not? Joel.
I'm not a substance abuse subspecialist. However, I would wonder how many primary care physicians have done the training, the paperwork, have their special DEA number, which you need for this. I happen to know that because I actually got this training. I've never actually prescribed buprenorphine because I do geriatrics and we don't have too many of those patients. But the question is how many primary care physicians in the entire United States do you think actually are eligible to prescribe? And is that a common enough phenomenon in our health system, in any sector of our health system, that this would be an efficiency in health care utilization that we would want to measure in a nationally reported measure? I don't know the answer, but I think that's an important question.
I see a lot of primary care physicians that do prescribe. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know how widespread the utilization of this would be, but if you were a substance abuse treatment program, that might not be an unreasonable thing to expect of yourself.
Yeah, I would agree, and I think you kind of get at the heart of the issue is that you have you have a drug treatment system that is highly regulated both from the patient standpoint and the provider standpoint, and that things can potentially get bottlenecked in terms of the turnover. And so what you're looking at is efficiency for care. And numbers involved the same as the larger SMI population? No, but for that group, it's incredibly important that we do it well.
But I wonder what data there is on once they get transferred, how effective the primary care providers who are licensed and eligible to do it, how effective they are at maintaining these people in treatment. Do we know that?
I don't know that this necessarily implied primary care. It implied ongoing care. And, I've read the...
Okay, to some continuing care providers that are not
a continuing care physician in the community. I think the reality is that very, very small percentage of PCPs are doing this type of treatment.
In response to my question, Anne was saying not so.
I think that there's a fairly large percentage, and I think probably for just these reasons that the drug treatment centers are saying you take it. It certainly isn't 80% or anything like that. But I bet just as a ballpark, I bet there's maybe 30 to 40%. Maybe it's a regional kind of thing.
I doubt it's that high in most sections.
What evidence, if any, is that this is a proximal outcome?
Okay, so we have about 15 minutes. Let's first of all vote. Is this within scope? Is it in scope? Raise your hand. You believe it's in scope, an outcomes measure. Raise your hands high. Five? Okay. Out of scope. Okay. Thank you. helped catch us up. It is 4:30. We have 15 minutes. I don't know if we want to address the next one, which is substance abuse, or begin that. Well, we are done for, I don't know if you want to go on to tomorrow mornings or do you want to stop here?
And Ian evidently split it into 3 and 2 because he thought that's just about where we would end, right? So the two other that you rated are first thing tomorrow morning. We continue with this work group.
Correct.
Then we go on to work group 3.
So what I'm asking, and I think we're going to argue up our time here, we've got about 15 minutes. Do you want to spend that on the next measure, or do you want to get out and enjoy the beautiful Washington weather? Or see the cherry blossoms or whatever else is on your agenda?
I think it's more efficient to do it all at once rather than, because we're going to have to just reiterate tomorrow morning what we discussed in the next 15 minutes.
So you want to do it now?
Get done. Oh, you mean extend and do the whole thing? That's different if you want to extend and do the whole thing.
Let's start tomorrow.
I think probably starting tomorrow would be the most efficient use of our time. I know. If we can have an agreement on that, we'll just wrap up today. Some key things tomorrow, we'll just prevent just a brief overview of discussions today, where we stand in terms of measures that we ended up with moving forward for potential endorsement, and those measures that we discussed but recommended might not go forward. Wanted to make a brief note that we will not be in the Brown-Rutnick offices tomorrow. We're actually going to be in our offices, which is our meeting floor. And I can send an email to everyone, so if you do have access to email. Well, I was going to tell them right now. So it is on the 6th floor. However, you went to the south side today. Our offices are on the north side. So what you're going to do is you're going to walk in the building and go to your left. And then you're going to be going on the north side of the building, go to the 6th floor. And as soon as you open up the doors, you'll be right at the NQF offices. Have a similar setup. We're not a lawyer group, and so we don't quite have all of the plushness of this room, but it should be sufficient for us tomorrow. And I think one of the main reasons that we are moving is that we do have access to a working phone, which will be much more helpful in facilitating the process. So,
And did you say that we go in a different entrance?
No, I just to clarify it again, you will go in the same entrance right here on 13th Street, and you go to the north side, which would be turning to your left. You can ask the security guard or the concierge down there if you need any help with that.
I want to thank everybody for their hard work and forbearance, and look forward to seeing everybody tomorrow morning.